Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. Today, my guest is Dr. Morgan Reynolds, PhD. Dr. Reynolds is currently a professor emeritus of economics at Texas A&M University, College Station, Texas. He's a former chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. He also served as a director of Criminal Justice Center and senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, headquartered in Dallas, Texas. Dr. Reynolds received his PhD in economics in 1971 from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He has taught and done research at several universities, including the Poverty Institute at the University of Wisconsin, University of California, and Texas A&M. He has served on the board of editors at the National Journal of Labor Research and the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics and the Journal of Libertarian Studies. In 1993-1994, Reynolds was a visiting scholar at the Joint Economic Committee for the U.S. Congress. He has been an adjunct scholar with the Cato Institute, and currently is an adjunct scholar with the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Among other professional affiliations, Dr. Reynolds has been a member of the Mont Pelerin Society and an international Society of Free Market Economists, Scholars, and Private Advocates. Dr. Reynolds, how are you doing today?
Hey, Timothy, it's good to be with you. I'm doing fine.
Thank you. And also, your website is nomoregames.com or .net.
.net. NoMoreGames.net. Yeah, go look at all that good stuff I got on that blog.
It was at that site that I follow a lot of your work, your various interviews, your late podcast I listen to frequently, too, Reynolds Reveals. And, you tackle a number of issues and smash a few icons along the way. One is the sainted Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the various war myths the American people have been fed throughout the centuries to justify the military-industrial complex. The 9/11, of course, and, of course, our fragile, shattered economy. Let's talk about it. How do you want to take those on? Lincoln, want to start with Abraham Lincoln?
Sure.
So, what's your take on Honest Abe and the so-called American Civil War?
He is contrary to being, the historians who are mostly statists, leftists of various types, rank him typically as the best president, just in front of, maybe by a big margin, George Washington. And then they put FDR 3. So it's really worth, that is Lincoln and Roosevelt are some of the worst people in the world. The only way to really understand them, I think, is to just begin with the proposition that they are psychopaths or / sociopaths. And those two words have no distinction between them. Call them either one. And Lincoln, in particular, for one thing, he was one of the least popular presidents ever. And that was for good cause, because he is the cause of the Civil War, so-called, or the War for Southern Independence. Okay, so I'm just looking at my article here, and this is called Cunning Pretexts for War, Lincoln, Roosevelt, 9/11. And it's kind of interesting how the these things happen. A lot of the 9/11 groups, none of them have invited me to give a talk or be part of a conference since 2007, okay? Which is probably pretty smart, because what happens, the way this article happened was I was speaking to a local group on the Civil War, and it happened to be nearly a year ago now, December 7th. Well, that was an anniversary of Pearl Harbor attack. And I was talking about the Lincoln and the first shot at Fort Sumter back in 1861. And it was only natural to pair this up because Lincoln was the guy that, in effect, misled the South. The South just wanted to secede. And as many have pointed out, what's wrong with that? Secession is perfectly natural, this kind of tendency towards decentralization and more local control over the awesome powers of government. And here's a part of this article to show you how important this is. There was no legal, and still is no legal, prohibition in the United States on secession. So maybe we'll have some down the road. You know, there was talk about it in Texas in particular. And certain counties in the various states have proposed secession. One example is the five western counties in Maryland. Of course, Maryland is overwhelmingly leftist. And these rural counties in the mountains there in western Maryland would love to go get free. And, you know, Lincoln constantly claimed that we'll stop the war if these traitors will stop the war. You know, there's a fake, a big lie. We're the peaceful types. And yet Lincoln maneuvered the South, outmaneuvered them into firing the first shot at Fort Sumter by he kept saying through his Secretary of State Seward, oh yeah, we're going to abandon these forts. You know, they did rapidly, like in New Orleans. So the Confederate States of America got a lot of nice silver, you know, temporary advantage. But they kept three, of which the most famous was Fort Sumter. And that one was a customs house. It's a place to collect the import tariffs, which were constituted 80% of the central state government's revenue. Okay, so they in the South was going to, in their constitution, they had, you know, no tariffs above 10% of value, and they were going to be a low tariff former part of the United States. And guess what? Northern industrialists thought this is terrible. You know, and their ports are going to prosper and thrive and take away trade from New York City and Baltimore and whatnot. So there was support for Lincoln, you know, by we'll call it the power elite, industrialists in the North. So at any rate, there was a lot of sweet talk early on by the Lincoln government. But then ultimately they sent military reinforcements because we're going to collect the tariff. He said that in his inaugural address. You know, we mean no harm to slavery, the institute, a peculiar institution, and da-da-da. So the South couldn't allow this. You can't allow the North to be collecting tariffs if you're going to be an independent government. So they fired on Fort Sumter. Nobody ultimately was injured. It was kind of a pinprick. And militarily, yet this did anger many in the North. So we got the war going. Okay, you know, the South has attacked our customs, the import station there. Oh my goodness, we got to go to war. And so it's all Lincoln's war. I quote a famous New Left historian at the University of Wisconsin at the time. He was a famous teacher in the 60s there in Madison. And Madison, of course, has a very left-wing culture. And I went there and I got 3 degrees and I loved it. Here's William Appleman Williams, where I studied, of course, in Madison. He says, put simply, the cause of the Civil War was the refusal of Lincoln and other Northerners to honor the revolutionary right of self-determination, the touchstone of the American Revolution, unquote. So this whole, just to add one more note on this, they are, after the defeat of the Southern states at enormous cost in human life, was a nation of 30 million, and now the estimates are that 850,000 people lost their lives in the war. And constantly accusing of – they treated Robert E. Lee and other military leaders kind of okay. You know, that's our militaristic tradition, but – the civilian, Jefferson Davis, who was a former U.S. senator and so on. Oh, yeah, he's a traitor. Well, mistreated him badly in prison. He was in prison for 2 years, and they were going to try him on who knows what charges. That was the problem. They brought in a couple of fancy New York attorneys, and both of them decided they wouldn't take the case because prosecuting Jefferson Davis, there was no case. There was no moral case, really, because Lincoln always approved of slavery and he was going to have ethnic removal cleansing, you know, by returning slaves back to Africa. He was a racist, you know, from A to Z. So this goes back to my original point about there's no legal prohibition on secession, and our country, once great, it was founded on a secession from the British Empire.
Yeah, you could argue that the South in 1861 had stronger legal precedent or justification for seceding from the North than the colonies did from the British Empire in 1776. Because it was implied in the Constitution. You mentioned secession, the right of secession, where is it being as American as apple pie? I think the first argument I heard in this case was when Thomas DiLorenzo wrote about it, that at the ratification convention, New York, Virginia, Rhode Island included clauses asserting the right to secede from the Union at a future time as a precondition for ratification. And This was accepted, and once that's accepted, that precondition would apply to all states. And of course, the first
right because it's never been contested.
And the first murmurings or cries for secession occurred not in the South but in the North, correct? In the New England states.
Yes, that was connected with the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. And Massachusetts and a couple of other New England states they had a convention up there. And
the Hartford Convention?
Huh?
The Hartford Convention?
That may be it. May be it. Because I'm a little foggy on this whole sequence. But, they decided by some kind of a vote or a decision to not press for secession. But isn't it ironic that the morally superior New Englanders were the first to seriously consider secession when they were terribly upset about the War of 1812?
And the fact they're so upset about it, I think Massachusetts refused to mobilize its militia in support of the war. And of course, there's also a lot of those steps kept up trade with the British during the war. And
take a look at Lincoln, how the maneuvers that he went through to keep the border states from secession as well, like Missouri, which is I'm living in Arkansas now for the last 13 plus years. And just north of us, of course, Arkansas is viewed as a very rural, if not backward, southern state. And then you had Maryland in particular, was, and you know, Lincoln, he jailed thousands of journalists, and he was even going to lock up the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, etc. I mean, it was a very tyrannical, dictatorial government, which people seem to, by and large, accept in times of war. You know, it's the biggest government program of all is war.
And the principle of secession, or I'm sorry, the principle of sort of nullification, and then interposition, then secession, was first written about. I guess it's implied in the Ninth and Tenth Amendment and the spirit of the Constitution, but I think it was Madison and Jefferson who wrote the Principles of 98, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, in response to the Alien and Sedition Acts. And I think the first test of it, of its practicality in restraining the federal government, I think you could argue, was the nullification crisis regarding the Treaty of Abominations in South Carolina, when it voted to nullify the treaty, and that forced the federal government to negotiate and lower the treaty, despite Jackson's opposition to South Carolina's maneuvering or measures in opposition to it. Jackson, I think, rejected South Carolina's assertion of its right to nullify and even secede, and even thought of mobilizing it. But he was forced to negotiate because South Carolina then had, had the physical means to assert its rights. I think they even passed a force measure. They were going to mobilize a militia and pay for an army to defend its sovereignty. But the takeaway from that crisis was the northern state, or the federal government, saw that this state was obviously in strong opposition to this tariff. And they lowered the tariff, and then the crisis went away.
Yeah, and on the eve of the Civil War, the Morrill tariff, which basically doubled and redoubled, it was scheduled to go to 47% of the prices of imports, which, of course, hit the South especially heavily because they imported lots of capital equipment and the like. And no doubt lots of commodities as well. But the South was the huge export earner by King Cotton. And so they just saw no future staying in the Union, although some of the writers and politicians recognized that it would make more difficult, if not impossible, to preserve the peculiar institution. Slavery.
That's true, because it was protected.
Because you lose the protection of the Anti-Fugitive Slave Acts and so on and so forth. It would have collapsed. The institution of slavery made it too easy to seek safe harbor or non-slavery in the South. In the North. But many of these sanctimonious northern states preening about slavery is awful, although that wasn't a widespread opinion actually in the first half of the 19th century. But many of them had anti-Negro term of the time, in Illinois, as a black or African-American person, you couldn't come into and establish a domicile in Illinois.
That's right. You had to post like a $10,000 bond or something, which is in effect a prohibition.
Yeah, prohibitive, right.
And you made a good point regarding slavery. Is outside federal protection, slavery simply would have eroded, gone away like it did perhaps in Brazil a couple of decades later in South America. I think Jeffrey Rogers Hummer makes that case in his book, Emancipating Slaves and Enslaving Freemen.
That's a great book. I've used that in American as one of the books in an American history, economic history.
Yeah, because there was a federal Fugitive Slave Act, part of the Compromise of 1850, which caused the northern states to nullify that federal law. So nullification was actually invoked more often in the North than it was in the South. And
I love nullification myself. Yeah. It's just one of the tools of liberty. Well, and jury nullification, I love that.
Yeah.
Because often the jury, you know how it is with voir dire, and each side in a criminal trial, let's say, a prosecution will throw out this potential juror. The defense will throw out that after questioning. But then they end up with a jury you really don't know.
Yeah, which is the ultimate check.
What they're going to do, and that I love, because if they take a dislike to the prosecution, they think this is an unfair and absurd, even if they were narrowly correct on the law, you know, that this ex-felon on probation, after 10 years, he possessed a firearm, let's say, you know, and because he's supposed to go through life never owning a firearm.
Yeah.
I remember seeing one video about this, and the jury just, they hated the prosecutor. This is not right. So they're going to do the right thing. I don't care what the statutes say.
Yeah, the hell with the law. I'm going to do. Yeah. We're going to do justice today, and that's the
right.
Ultimate power is the juror, and judges hate to admit that. It's why they never instruct jurors of juror nullification. Well,
that's
should.
Right. That you are the law.
Yes.
Yeah, you 12 citizens tried and true, yes.
But Thomas DiLorenzo writes, he's talking about states' rights and liberty, and this is the tragedy of the so-called American Civil War was the destruction of state sovereignty in the creation of sort of a unitary state by force.
Yeah, when it matters, we're a unitary state, yes.
Yeah. He said states' rights or federalism never meant that state politicians were somehow more moral, wise, or less corrupt than national politicians. The idea always was that, number one, it's easier for the people to keep an eye on and control politicians the closer they are to them, and two, a decentralized system of government consisting of numerous states provided American citizens with an escape hatch from tyrannical governments. They can more or less pass as, you know, some sort of arbitrage. They can, you know, if the state becomes too bad,
right,
move to another
state.
Right,
and you've got competition among the states
because
of the ease of relocation.
And so this isn't to say that a decentralized system is going to have problems, you know, but obviously a centralized system is going to be much more attractive to the corrupt elements that we're all familiar with today. I mean, to organize. This is why, you know, corporations and oligarchs always want national legislation to control things, you know.
Well, look at this recent event now with the Bundys out there in Oregon.
Oh, they're acquittal, yeah.
And I love the fact that the defense, of course, the jury turned out to rule in favor of the defendants who are being prosecuted by, I guess, the feds, because that's, quote, they own this National Wildlife Refuge in eastern Oregon. And what they relied on, at least for part, but this is a really central point. Because this is an obscure, I didn't realize the import of this. It's in Article 1, which empowers the U.S. Congress, Article 1. And then in Section 8, which is the key part of this whole authorization of power to the Congress. And the Congress they thought of as being the preeminent branch. Yeah, you got three branches, but the Congress would be the closest to the people. And it says, in part, that the Congress can, quote, exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be. This is a quote for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Well, you know, what this points out is, okay, the federal government controls over half the land in the western United States. But how did they get it? They never got permission of any state legislature. They never purchased anything, okay? So here we got, you know, this was an important part that at least the court allowed this argument in. You know, the way they'll deny their ability to present evidence regarding certain things. So this is a very important outcome, I think.
But we're talking about... we're talking about Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War, this very destructive war that he waged against the South, and all the burning of cities, Atlanta, Sherman's
march to the sea.
You have the Valley Campaign, Shenandoah Valley.
Now, you know what drove that? This is vindictive, it kind of leads to ultimately to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, mm-hmm. you know, cities of civilians with no military value, occupied at that time in Japan mostly by women, children, and old men, or at least men who are not really of any military value at this point in their lives. And that's exactly, Sherman is one monster, okay? Monstrous in terms of, because of course the South supported generally, certainly the white population had enough. It wasn't just that their politicians were off the reservation. No, they represented certainly white Southern opinion. So it was vindictive destruction to punish the South. And a guy like Sherman, William Tecumseh Sherman, wants to keep this going forever. Okay? And as somebody said, I guess you could kind of appreciate it when, as somebody said recently, not too long ago, at least in modern times, the South is a nation locked within a nation. It's still true, even after a lot of northern migration to the South.
Yeah, it's a conquered province now.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong. And Lincoln actually understood how libertarian or anarchical this principle of the right of secession is. That ultimately, he argued that, hey, this is just leads to anarchy, which I got no problem with, Abraham. See, we know you got some smarts.
And, well, yeah,
but it's not an argument against decentralization. Yeah. In fact, decentralization is the trend in the world, and not just because of the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, you got the Czechs, dissociating with the Slovaks, etc. And there's nothing wrong with this because, at least to a lot of economists, you know, these political borders are just places on the map, the geographic map. And you can still, so it allows for free trade if the governments are amenable and so on and so forth. You know, cultural exchanges, travel. It's not a problem. Europe got rich with small places.
Yep. And, well, what happened was that when the South seceded, it threatened, what did Lincoln say? What of my tariff, right? He didn't say what will happen to the slaves. Because mm-hmm. the tariff backed up the Whig and then the Republican agenda of, you know, big government, internal improvements, which was sort of corporate welfare.
Yeah, the American plan.
The American system and these things. And
it's crony capitalism is another term.
And the South had to be conquered because the South became a source of cheap labor and resources. It's very typical of an imperial project. But what secession did, the tragedy of the outcome of the Civil War was secession, or the threat of secession, was always intended to be a possible means of maintaining the voluntary union and true constitutional government, because the threat of secession and nullification would check federal ambition. And
that
other than relying on federal judges to check federal power, which is absurd.
That's a joke.
I know. There's actually a corporate physical block to federal ambition. And that was in the sovereignty of the states. And the whole idea of the Constitution beginning was basically, it wasn't to create a national government. The United States of America was not a nation state. It was a confederation of sovereign states had come together for the purposes of creating a common market and mutual defense. And that was pretty much
it. It was supposed to be a commercial republic.
Yeah.
Now, there were some people, though, of course, like Alexander Hamilton comes to mind, who were centralists, you know, central banks, big army.
Of course, yes.
And the Constitution, unfortunately, there wasn't anything wrong with the prior model of the Confederation. And you could have had – now, it's true that it was a beggar. It had to go to the state governments to try and get support. So much the better from my point of view. If there really is a national defense problem – the states are going to come to the rescue, you know. And you could have had Dwight Lee, an economist friend of mine. He proposed in print, look, you could have had a rule like 10% of the tax revenues of each state would go to support the central government. But still, in other words, that had the power arrangement right.
Yes. But again, if the South had won and America had been split into two nations, then the United States could not have intervened in the First World War and saved made the world safe for democracy.
Yeah, all pretty good. Yeah. Oh, well, you know, now here's another aspect of this. The great Thomas Jefferson, for the most part, recognized that, okay, we got this continent and we're adding territory and you know, this is a problem, and he proposed that the United States would split up into a South, a Northeast, and a West, and those would be central government, because the thing, it just gets too unwieldy. The individual gets lost and is influential, and you know, you got different. In a sense, cultures over here and different needs and ends. So, but he never did anything about it. He recognized that this is a problem. It's such an immense. I remember going to lunch one time in Washington, D.C. when I was on Capitol Hill there for a year as a visitor. And these people from the Swiss embassy wanted to talk to me. Okay. We'll go out to lunch. And I didn't understand this at the time, but this woman from the Swiss embassy, she says to me, America isn't a country, it's a continent. Well, she come from Switzerland, which is geographically relatively small, but Switzerland was politically modeled on the U.S., and they've done a better job of keeping that model. With these cantons, you know, yeah. Have a great deal of local autonomy. And the model was supposed to be a commercial republic. But now look at where we are. It's just way off track.
It's an empire of liberty. Yeah.
Right. A round circle. Yeah.
But
Ice Cube, come on. Yeah, this is an oxymoron. You can't have an empire and liberty.
So it's, you know, I think this was best illustrated, I think, after the Civil War. There's a correspondence between Robert E. Lee and Lord Acton in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote to Lee in 1866, and he wrote, "I saw in states' rights the only availing check upon the absolutism of the sovereign will, and succession filled me with hope, not as destruction, but as the redemption of democracy, the institutions of your republic, have not exercised on the old world the salutary and liberating influence which ought to have belonged to them, by reason of those defects and abuses of principle which the Confederate Constitution was expressly and wisely calculated to remedy. I believe that the example of the great reform would have blessed all the races of mankind by establishing true freedom, purged of the native dangers and disorders of republics. Therefore, I deemed that you were fighting the battles of our liberty, our progress, and our civilization. And I mourn for the stake which was lost at Richmond more deeply than I rejoice over that which was saved at Waterloo, which of course would have been the defeat of Napoleon." So that's Lord Acton's take on it.
Here, let me. There's another aspect of this that I often wondered about, and that is, what if the South had tried instead of died of West Point to, in other words, fewer of these European-style joining of opposing forces, which the South ultimately is going to lose down the road because of inferior resources, especially young men. I often wondered about this, but and I was really wondering about it when last year at Thanksgiving, we were driving home, and it's 1,000 miles. We're driving home from Winchester, Virginia, which is up there in the northern, it's north of you in northern Virginia. Okay. and it's near the Maryland line. And then we go to Hot Springs, Arkansas. That's 1,000 miles. Now look, the Confederacy went to El Paso, Texas. That's another 1,000 miles. That's two. This is an immense territory, 2,000 miles from one end to the other. And imagine the North trying to occupy this thing, okay, for indefinitely. That ain't going to be cheap. And then people in the North find out, well, what's in it for me? You know. So now the problem was that the only way to win a guerrilla war, and this is here comes from another review on Mises.com, or pardon me, LouRockwell.com. And Max Boot, who's one of these neocons, but he came out with this book on guerrilla warfare. Now, most of the time, the guerrilla warfare doesn't work. But where it does, it seems to rely on aid from the outside. And the English, they had an interest in seeing America maybe split up a bit, you know, to its own advantage. And not necessarily nefarious advantage. And the trouble was that the South had, what should we say, poor PR. It had poor image because of black slavery. So they couldn't really get the liberal, classical liberal, little L, Brits to back them or support them, and they had no support outside the South. So it's unlikely that the guerrilla warfare tactic would have succeeded in achieving Southern independence.
Yes. I think we've covered Lincoln. That's the next icon. I think you've written much about and spoken about is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the man who saved capitalism.
Yes,
and defeated Hitler and Tojo.
Right. Well put. Oh yeah, it's like Lincoln freed the slaves and you know, created the unitary state.
Well, first let's take on the Great Depression.
Yeah, we need to go to the Great Depression now. When you think about, now, first of all, you know, what a bad guy this is, FDR. You know, he connived with Winston Churchill, who FDR was an expert on the Navy. He was Secretary of the Navy for quite a while. Well, the whole Lusitania sinking was a setup. It was a British warship, meaning, you know, they're transporting arms and ammo and bombs, etc. Even though, yeah, they have this, it's almost like a civilian hostage situation. They have
babies and bullets,
passengers aboard, etc. So the evil Winston Churchill, he set up the sinking of the by a U-boat, and the Germans said, "Don't get on this Lusitania." They had ads and an ad or two in the New York newspapers of the day. And all the facts are, so this goes way back. Now, when FDR succeeded Herbert Hoover, remember, Herbert Hoover was a progressive Republican. In other words, he's a lefty. And there are all kinds of problems with Herbert Hoover. But Hoover and the Hoovervilles, remember the Great Depression, it traces back to the Federal Reserve, yes, but even worse, the reason that it was made, you had an ordinary kind of recession, was converted into a Great Depression, was the actions of the government, the intervention. So President Herbert Hoover, for example, said, we got to keep wages high, you know, so that we'll have purchasing power. What? You're going to get them all unemployed.
Yeah,
you know, the price of labor, you know, it needs to stay high, and then the prices that the corporations get for the products needs. So we're going to all pledge to not cut wages. We're not going to cut prices. Well, you know, during a collapse, you got to allow the market and the cleansing. That's it's unfortunate, but hey, the government causes these booms. And then the bust is simply the sobering up. It's the cleansing. It's the hangover, okay? That's where you get healthy.
Yeah.
Not the party the night before.
The plus side of deflation is lower prices.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It helps restore the economy. Yeah. You need to get pricing near market clearing values. To have maximum employment, you got to have prices that clear the market.
And it was Harding who more or less did nothing in 1921, and which produced a remarkable recovery, because they had a really acute downturn in 2021, which is probably worse than the 29 downturn.
And well, it was severe, but it was post World War One, and what public opinion was at the time? Everything is too high. So you had public support. It's kind of like in the late 19th century, people would say, you know, supply and demand, that's like the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
Don't mess with supply and demand. You're going to get, you know, really brutalized. This is like going against the tide, you know, no more high tide at this hour.
Well, wasn't also because...
How's that going to work?
Also, the 20s, this is part of these central bank scheming, because at the Genoa Conference, you had these... the gold exchange standard was reimposed to try to float the English pound at par with the dollar.
No,
So there's all kinds of problems.
It was mistaken monetary policy in the 20s. Yeah. But now the interesting thing was that since FDR succeeded Herbert Hoover, well, in 1920-21, when this post-war serious recession hit, Herbert Hoover was all for intervention. We've got to do something. Warren Harding says, what? Are you kidding? And the thing lasted 12 months.
Yeah.
And so get rid of the malinvestment, the things that are no longer suitable. You get resources in better hands. The thing reorganizes. You reestablish the foundation for healthy economic growth.
And also the backstory to this is a repudiation of gold in 1914 by all the belligerent nations. So all the distortions of the Great War had to be cleared out, had to be readjusted.
That's true. Yeah. And then, you know, once you have your depression and money prices come down and wages do too, you know, this was a temporary suspension of convertibility, so-called. And, you know, we were never on a really ideal gold standard. But people used to take them at their word. They'd support the bonds without getting panicky high interest, et cetera, et cetera. And the governments used to have bourgeois mentality. And so they would allow the deflation, and then you could reestablish the so-called convertibility into precious metals, and it would kind of work, okay, given that there are all these distortions that they generate to begin with. But you get back on the wrong track like Britain did. You know, Britain basically grew all these aggressive unions. Plus, they started unemployment compensation, insurance, and on and on. Well, when you've got these kinds of non-capitalist organizations, and you substitute fluidity for infirmity, it ain't going to work so nicely in terms of suffering the recession. The point I wanted to make here was Herbert Hoover, always the progressive Republican. He basically had a kind of a smaller New Deal. He did everything wrong that drove us downward from an ordinary recession / cleansing to a really serious problem. And then FDR, 1932, campaigns as a Democrat, kind of a Southern platform almost, denouncing all of these interventions that are counterproductive by Herbert Hoover. And then guess what? We go in and we have 100 days and we have interventions. We go with the National Recovery Act to cartelize the economy. And instead of looking at price deflation as an attempt to reorganize the economy properly and restore full employment output, they get these cartels, and they mistake falling prices as a symptom of the problem, as a cause of the problem. And it's really just, it's not, it's more than a symptom. It's,
yeah, but
to be realistic about pricing.
I listened to my my high school history teacher, and I read the textbooks, and I've watched American Experience on FDR. It was his fireside chats that ended the Great Depression.
Really? That's great. You know, if only you know, Obama had done more chatting at by the fireside, right?
Yeah, listen to the radio. But yeah, you're right about that. Is people don't realize is that he campaigned as a sound money, tax cuts, fiscal discipline, and John Nance Garner, his first VP.
Yes.
First VP, accused Hoover of leading the country down the path of socialism.
Yeah.
In 1932.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
You know.
And now here's the thing. Of course, the New Deal and all the interventions, which were really in a sense modest by subsequent standards, never got us out of the Great Depression. In fact, they kept us in there. It's very much like our 8 years of non-recovery now. And so FDR was frustrated and wanted to get in a really big program, and that's called World War II.
Now we have Pearl Harbor, right?
When Hitler, yeah. So this is forecasting Pearl Harbor. Well, Hitler was very careful, you know. In September 1, 1939, the war starts in Europe. And this is kind of – which, by the way, was a continuation of an unfinished World War I. You know, we hadn't murdered enough people, 10 million plus. So, but I mean, the whole betrayal of the Treaty of Versailles and sticking it to Germany, that's why that created a Hitler, you know, because there were legitimate grievances. You said, you know, we had a Germany won most of the battles at enormous cost in life. But the French, you know, charging in there, and then the stupid Americans, our entry, it was disastrous, and it leads to World War II. In any case, September 1, 1939. Now, Hitler was really careful to not annoy the U.S. enough to get into the war, even though we do lend lease with Churchill, et cetera, and it's clear if we were going to enter, what side we were going to be on.
Yeah, we were attacking his U-boats, and they're running away from our ships.
Right. Yeah, they don't want the U.S. to enter on the side of Britain. So this, of course, how are we going to deal with getting into the war? And it's partly because he couldn't solve the unemployment problem with all his programs. Well, you put 12 million men under arms, you solve your unemployment problem. So here again, there's an economic background that is more or less hidden from public view, because nothing so crass as somebody's making money or not making money should matter. You know, it's all ideological and all noble and whatnot. Okay, so FDR. Okay, some interchangeability there.
Yeah, well, they both came to power in 1933.
He should have been hung after a nice trial, you know, which concludes on Saturday morning, and then we hang some, and George C. Marshall and all these traitors, okay, because they arranged, they suckered the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor. And they did it by hook and crook. Now, one of them was the whole oil market sanctioned. We're going to shut down. We aren't going to allow oil to be purchased by Japan. And then you wonder why, you know, they want to expand into a Japanese sphere of influence. It's like Hitler said, you know, Germany, hey, we're a small place. We need elbow room, Lebensraum.
Okay?
They want to annex. It's just very much like OIL, you know, oil Israel, and we're not invading Iraq. You know, it had nothing to do with oil. Yeah, right. Okay, it's got something to do with oil companies. You know, they thought they were going to use Iraqi oil to actually make money off the invasion. Remember that? Oh, it's contrary to international law. Well, I don't care. You know, we're going to go after the terrorists.
It'll pay for itself.
It'll pay for itself. Right. you know, how can these, it's like Hillary, Rotten Clinton, how can they just lie, you know, so well? That's why I could never make it in politics, because once I started telling one of these lies, I'd grin a little or smirk, you know. But there's a straight face. It's just amazing, and how this can sell well when you got the corporate media as a loudspeaker. Why not? But at any rate, here's the most devastating fact I would propose about how FDR and his henchmen arranged Pearl Harbor, and therefore the death of 2,600 American servicemen, mostly. There were a couple dozen, I forget the number, but double-digit numbers of civilians killed as well in the attack. But a week before Pearl Harbor, approximately, they cleared out the North Atlantic of all commercial traffic so that the Japanese fleet could steam across. This is a big ocean. Steam across the Pacific to their rendezvous point 200 miles north of Pearl and launch the attack on a Sunday morning. And then, you know, one of the things that really corks me is they basically smeared the two commanders there, Walter Short, the Army commander, and husband Kimmel, the Navy commander. Okay? They were derelict in their duty and whatnot. And hell, Kimmel was smart enough to have the carriers out on exercises that morning, you know. So, and, you know, the battleships and the tragedy of the many men trapped in the Arizona that they couldn't save, you know, they're tapping away. This is, as one guy, Mr. Denson, put it, they ought to have that for the FDR memorial there in Washington, D.C., the tapping for 2 weeks by men trapped in an overturned Arizona. And, you know, the battleships weren't really useful anymore because they were too dang slow, you know.
Yeah, they were World War One, vintage World War One.
Yeah, relics of World War One. So, yeah. Any rate, the whole thing is, FDR and some of our other heroes, it's just outrageous. And, the historians did a 180. The historian said, oh, poor FDR, he didn't know. Well, he fired Richardson, you know, the commander of the Pacific Fleet there. Admiral Richardson. They fired FDR, remember, is an expert on the Navy. And he wanted Richardson to transfer the fleet from the Pacific Fleet from San Diego out to Hawaii, which is a trap. And Richardson, he goes in there and he says, you know, he's mistaken. I got to convince him. Well, after the meeting, Roosevelt fired him and replaced him with husband Kimmel, who is a patriot, no doubt a capable guy. But they kept Short and Kimmel completely uninformed. And then the historian said, oh, you know, they couldn't break the codes of the Japanese Navy. That's another lie.
Mm-hmm.
And, proven by the Robert Stinnett book, who spent 17 years researching on FOIA requests to get the naval records. And they just denied, and they knew everything. I mean, the guys in Washington did, but they didn't let Kimmel and Short in on it. So it's a total setup, and there were a lot of people at the time, this is like 9/11, who knew it right away. It was a setup. It's an FDR, you know, FDR, of course, it was a transparent jerk, you know, from Hyde Park and whatnot. You know, he's a lying SOB. Everything else, you know, this is for family consumption, but... But, you know, to put him as the third greatest, this shows you what we've got in the Yankee problem in history, how propagandized it is. It's absolute a bunch of lies about every important issue.
Yeah, as far as the intrigue in Pearl Harbor, it's more or less, even his defenders admitted that he knew, he had foreknowledge, but they defended, even Robert Stinnett says it was necessary to get the United States into the war to fight a crusade against Nazi Germany. And
yes, which is another joke. That is a complete lie, because the frickin' Nazi Germany couldn't get across the English Channel.
No, remember he had that map, the British gave, and they showed they were planning to invade South America via Africa, then come up to Mexico. Now, they couldn't get across the channel, as you say. Not to mention their armies were stuck in the ice in Moscow, right outside Moscow.
So their
offensive at Barbarossa had failed, and so the idea of Germany conquering the world, which is always ridiculous, because that was never Hitler's plan. Even Japan. I mean, Japan was seeking the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, which is basically they were trying to carve out a European style sphere of influence, which is no different than the Monroe Doctrine. And not to mention the fact that we're accusing Japan of Germany trying to conquer the world. Meanwhile, we're allying ourselves with the British Empire, which arguably had already conquered the world.
Yeah, the sun never sets.
Not to mention allying ourselves with Stalin, who in 1941 had far more deaths on his hands than his adversary Hitler in Berlin. I mean, there's no moral.
Yeah, well, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. We got what is predicted to be the winning candidate for president of the United States. And she sees an enormous threat. She's threatened Putin, the head of the Russian government, with nuclear war. She's threatened Iran of just turning it into a wasteland.
Yeah.
On. And you just got to, what threat do they pose? And then now the Donald, on the other hand, I'm going to wipe out ISIS. I said, what's in it for me? Why are you guys, just because Hillary wants to be in there, and we are in there with Obama and whatnot, Assad, Bashar Assad is a bad guy. Oh, spare me. And all you're doing is harm. Don't you ever hear the Hippocratic oath about your interventions?
Yes.
Do no harm, buddy.
Well, people like Assad are pussycats compared to the Western leaders and what they do, and the oligarchs who control them. So, and if you want to defeat ISIS, just cut off the funding.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, pretty simple. It's a NATO operation. I mean, it's until the Israelis to stop supporting. It's a NATO, it's Anglo-American Zio operation.
Yeah, who benefits from this chaos? Right.
Exactly. It's Israel and NATO and all this stuff. It's all about destabilization, and who knows the ultimate thing there. But you're right. I mean, FDR set up Pearl Harbor. He provoked Japan's attack to get us into the war. It was his backdoor to war. It's been correctly called, and we're into the war. And Dr. New Deal becomes Dr. Win the War. And as you mentioned, 12 million people go into the ranks of military. Unemployment is solved. But even then, you don't get a recovery until the demobilization and the drastic budget cuts after World War II.
Yeah, and which cured itself. Remember all those Keynesian economists? Oh, you're putting all these guys out on the street and there's going to be a disaster. No. Mm-hmm. First of all, we had, you could call it pent-up consumption demand. Well, okay, I'll meet the Keynesians halfway on that. But production must precede consumption.
There's no demand in Africa right now. That's why they're poor. Low demand.
But this whole thing, because of a relative hands off, and they took off gradually the price controls. Allowed the market to work. It reorganized itself quite nicely. I mean, these guys can't. Hear the message of history here properly understood when it comes to the economy.
But there were some, if you look at it, even the post-war boom, which if you look at how the global economy, because we're talking about World War II, the creation of the Bretton Woods system and military Keynesianism, as it's become to be called.
Military Keynesianism.
Yeah, the post-war system, while I think there were some very healthy aspects to the political economy after the Second World War, it was fundamentally unstable because it was based on this Bretton Woods system, which was this the imposition of the dollar as the world
supposedly was linked to gold.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the ultra phony gold standard, right?
Yeah, so let's talk about, you know, the 50s. We have the prosperity of the 50s and the 60s. This is the Cold War period, high Cold War period. And then we get the 60s, and, you know, we're allegedly putting men on the moon. At least we're putting on a show to that effect. But we're spending the money. we're spending the money. We want to get into that a little bit. But we have Vietnam, this guns and butter policy, and all of a sudden the strains of the Bretton Woods system become too much, and it collapses when de Gaulle simply calls in tells Bretton Woods to honor its obligation to pay out gold. And so
I got all this paper dollars, so you give me an ounce of gold for every 35.
I guess how I understand it was for the first decade or so, it worked because Europe's economy had been destroyed through the war, its industry. So there was a lot of demands for dollars, but as the European economy recovered, the demands for dollars dropped, and they started accumulating all these dollars. And of course, Germany's under occupation, so despite its West Germany, despite its robust recovery, they're not going to.
That guy Earhart was a hero because he wanted to free up the German economy to work, and that worked.
Yeah, I think he instituted the currency reforms on a weekend when everyone was.
Yeah.
But what happened was. France, and this goes into the politics of Charles de Gaulle. De Gaulle was a skeptic about NATO and the Anglo-Americans, and he started challenging the Bretton Woods system in the mid-60s, and this was the gold crisis. But the Americans, they blamed de Gaulle, and they blamed speculators, but they didn't blame the U.S. government and its spendthrift ways in the 60s.
Oh, right, because, you know, the key part about Bretton Woods was fixed exchange rates, which among all these fiat paper money currencies. And, you know, the most irresponsible had to devalue or you get all kinds of untoward international. In other words, let's say the British pound is overvalued. And hey, that will hurt their exports, and they'll run these trade deficits, and so on and so forth. But the simple way to put it is, it's out of whack with the supply and demand situation. It's mispriced, it's overvalued. So it turns out that Bretton Woods fixed exchange rates, you know, which is modeled on a one money world. Okay, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, where all the major nations are on a gold standard, there's only one. Everything is gold as long as they can honor their commitments. Okay, and in peacetime they could and did. All right, so that you could call it fixed exchange rates. In other words, you needed five paper dollars to buy one British pound. Okay. Well, it's because of their weight in gold. All right, so the fixed exchange rate, that's we'll call it the intellectual inspiration for fixed exchange, but they don't work. It's an impossible thing when you've got fixed prices. That's what it amounts to. And reality gets away from those fixed prices. So then you go to periodic flexible rates where they are allowed to change and will keep. And then finally the whole thing breaks down. Nobody is in fixed.
Because there's no reality backing it up.
Right.
Whereas under the classical gold system, when you have a classical gold standard, if there's a shortage of specie in a country, prices will drop. Then the specie will flow into that country because the lower prices attract the specie.
Right. There's your classical economics.
Yeah.
Right.
But the thing is, politics intervenes, namely war. Then you have with war, you get the welfare state and you get the politics of the welfare
and
state.
And the warfare state and the central banks. Yes. In other words, it's all funny money.
Yeah.
It is not honest money, which is, hey, the government can't print gold or even silver. So, yeah. And you know, you go back to the whole basis for what becomes money is it's the most liquid or marketable commodity. It's a real commodity that has non-monetary uses. In the prisoner of war camps, there's a famous article by R.A. Radford. During World War II, the money was cigarettes. You know, even if you don't smoke, you use cigarettes.
Yeah, yeah.
Buy things. And, of course, you do get inflation, meaning a debasement of the cigarettes where they put in fake tobacco. But still, you understand why the most marketable or liquid commodity yeah. becomes money. And gold is money. And, you know, the hopeful thing would be that in the next collapse and market collapse in particular, the U.S. stock market, we will have an opportunity. The central bank, the Fed here, is going to be discredited. And we need to, the best thing that can happen is, hey, you know, the classical gold standard would actually be considered. And, there's a ray of hope there. And because what are they going to do? What's the left going to do? Everybody knows this committee of wise people led by a school marm is not up to the task. Why, for example, can't the marketplace determine interest rates? Well, the thing is, it could do it very nicely, thank you, without any intervention. And it would really do the job of wiping out or short-circuiting unfounded speculation in certain stocks, for example, because the carry trade it disappears. Hey, guys, you can't rely on the Fed to just keep the interest rates near the zero bound. Interest rates can shoot up very quickly. Okay, all of a sudden they're 15%. Well, maybe that borrowing I wanted to do to buy some paper assets isn't worth it. It's a little too risky for me. So a lot of the disciplines of the marketplace are just being overrun by bad central banking, and there's no point to have a central bank in the first place. You know, if you had now, there this gets into maybe some technical area, but. But banks are basically frauds, okay?
Well, yeah, because of fractional reserve.
They don't obey yes. ordinary contract law. They've got a special privilege or immunity, okay? And that's because they can keep on hand only enough money, kind of 10% of the checking deposits, keep 10% on hand to service ordinary demands for cash. Instead of having all of your money there. So in other words, there it's a fraud game. And during a bank panic, that's when the real disciplinary mechanism comes in, which they've got short-circuited once again. We need to have bank failure, of course. And I mean real failure. You know, the government, the taxpayers doesn't come in and bail out the depositors. We need all these kinds of mechanisms to monitor and discipline these banksters.
Well, yeah, you'd have under a free market, you might have warehouse banking where a small
yes.
fee is paid. Then you might have investment banking where you have CDs.
They're separate. Yeah,
separate. That's completely.
And
separate,
if they're the same, okay, but you better keep these accounts separate.
Yeah, and also the threat of a bank run, a failure would discipline the banks. As opposed to having a guarantee of a federal
and invention. Here's another aspect of where we have gone wrong, and that is these big investment banks used to be partnerships, and that made them a lot more careful.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the partners are monitoring each other now. Since they're publicly held, 18 steps left of the whoopee.
Yeah.
So, we're going to rely on the SEC and other, come on.
Well, how about the notion that there should never be a market downturn?
Oh, yeah.
There should be no pain
in life.
Yeah. I mean, where
Timothy,
do they get that?
What we need, now, the federal government will be there, with a cushion to help you on cushion you against any fall.
Well, that, absolutely. Yeah, there's that plunge protection team, which I think started in 87 or something. And, well, it's the President's Working Group on Markets, I think is the official term. But what they're admitting is if there's a downturn, they're going to come in with funny money and pump up the market. Now, if I am a keen market observer and I'm looking at the fundamentals, I'm observing reality, and I bet on a market downturn because I'm doing my homework, who are they to step in and burn me? Because I've assessed the situation.
Oh, yeah. I've gotten burned by Bernanke. Oh, yeah.
And this is what this quantitative easing was. It was subsidizing Wall Street to tune of, what, like $40 billion a month?
I don't know what. We had that in – the guy who was the inspector general had a report after TARP. And I don't remember. Remember, TARP was a $750 billion on the U.S. budget.
Yeah,
bailout fund, and
change.
This is quite apart from the nearly $20 trillion in guarantees and actually payouts by the Fed. But the Inspector General, he said, "Yeah, if you look at the Federal Reserve and everything on budget, it's up around $20 trillion."
Yeah.
Woo-hoo-hoo! And Timothy there and Morgan, they didn't get a dime of this. And I was remember TARP, when it went up for the first vote, it got defeated because the traffic was heavy up to Capitol Hill, and they were running 101 against voting for this damn bill.
Yep.
And but then and it was defeated. And man, it was I cheering. I thought this was a historic moment. Well, they recrafted it, you know, put in certain. Slush money for different votes, and 2 weeks later they passed a second version of it. I mean, what does that tell you about the Republican Party?
Mm-hmm.
They're all rhinos. In other words, some of them will talk about free enterprise and small government on the the campaign trail, and then they get in there and they're the biggest bunch of losers ever.
Well, it's almost like the Vietnam scenario. You had to destroy capitalism to save it. You know, that's
yeah.
You know, yeah, whether they didn't. I mean, David Stockman did a good work on this about the overstated consequences of a collapse to justify the bailout.
Yeah. In other words, all the big guys, all the masters of the universe, are going to collapse. Hoop. Yes.
Yes. Exactly. And there's going to be smaller and mid-sized firms. They're going to step in and pick up the pieces.
And these are the losers that are backing Hitler. You know, it's just incestuous. It's just
Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan.
These guys are losers.
Yeah.
They would have been out of business.
You know. And whatever happened to Robert Rubin and Greenspan and Larry Summers? Weren't they the committee that saved the world? Remember them back in Time Magazine?
You know what? Okay, these guys, I was on Capitol Hill 93-94, and I was actually, in effect, appointed by Dick Armey. He was then second in command to Newt Gingrich, the House Republicans. And then we had the contract with America, and the Republicans got a majority of the House. Well, on one occasion, I wasn't directly involved, although I really like Dick Armey, but he was going to have breakfast with Alan Greenspan, and he was really, I guess you could say, nervous about it because Dick Armey has a PhD in economics, and he was on the faculty at University of North Texas State before his political career. And so he was really, really nervous, whereas I would have gone in there. And he was the maestro, Greenspan. Whereas to me, he's Mr. Magoo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on, this guy is. And you could see, being a sound money guy and an economist, you can see how badly this all is going to work and how badly it's going to end. And yet, he was the toast of Washington D.C. This
Correct.
Is just how myopic people can be.
Well, I think perhaps Dick Armey might have realized that when you're talking to someone like Greenspan, the Federal Reserve chairman, he might be too close to the crooks that really run the global system.
Maybe that's it. He's worried about his grandchildren.
Well, ultimately, you're dealing with gangsters that have that pretty much are willing to do anything to maintain their power
that's
and wealth.
True, but,
and so it's not a question.
I don't think that was the issue, really.
But it was, who was it? Was it Lewis McFadden who used to say tough things about the Federal Reserve, and he ended up being poisoned or something? So,
well, you know, some people would point to JFK. Remember how he, JFK made a lot of enemies in terms of, the CIA most immediately, but talking about the Treasury and the Federal Reserve and getting everything shaped up somehow or other, although I believe it was Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover, if you read the Philip F. Nelson has two fantastic books pointing at LBJ. Here's the guy who's qui bono. Who's going to benefit most immediately? Frickin' LBJ. And as Richard Nixon said, hey, I wanted the presidency just like LBJ. The difference was I wasn't willing to murder to do it.
Oh, they're definitely involved in the cover-up. That's
no oh, yeah, yeah, sure. That's what you had to have. Well, that's how LBJ, he and Hoover were neighbors. They're a couple doors away across the street. And, when LBJ, of course, LBJ was dirt from the beginning, but he'd have his come let us reason sessions. Well, he had all that Hoover information, all the scandalous stuff when it was a scandal to have an amour outside marriage and so on,
Yep.
And so it was basically blackmail was his favorite weapon.
Apparently that's how they got Earl Warren to chair the commission.
That might be.
Yeah,
that
there's a tape. One of LBJ tapes.
Warren didn't want to do it, right, at first.
Yeah, that's in Russell Baker's book regarding the Bush fam,
The Bush crime family. Yeah,
very good book about that. And he talks.
Oh, I read that book, but I don't recall him saying that it was blackmailing Earl Warren.
There's a tape or something where LBJ refers to something in Mexico and Earl Warren breaks down crying or something and accepts the commission. So who knows what it was.
Yeah.
That's a whole other thing. That I think with Kennedy, there was a whole milieu. The Yankee cowboy interests, the military industrial complex. Some people even think Israel played a part in it because of his pressuring the American Zionist Council.
The H-bomb.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And all that. The arms smuggling that was going on in the country at the time regarding the bomb for Israel. And he certainly ruffled a lot of feathers, and perhaps whether he was ideal or naive, both him and his brother, despite their many flaws.
Well, it's also the case that JFK was, in an important sense, uncontrollable. It's very much like Donald Trump scares the hell out of the power elite.
Yeah, not perfect. But
JFK had his own money. Yeah, it was from Papa Joe. But, he's charismatic as hell. You know, this Clinton, Bill Clinton, the charmer, he's not even close to the JFK or RFK charisma, man.
And I do think that with JFK, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think he sort of stared into the abyss and stared back at him, and he had this conversion, and also the fact that, of course, they were Catholic, which really
he had a come to God meeting there.
Yeah, but the
well, that's when he turned to peace. Well, plus, of course, he had his World War II PT-109 experience, so he wasn't a huge fan of warfare, I don't think, even though, these campaigns, you don't know what they're going to do in office. Remember, he was beating Nixon over the head with the Cuban or the missile cap.
The missile cap, yeah.
It's got almost nothing to do with what they're going to do in office.
Yeah, that was a Rand Corporation thing, the missile cap thing, and they could play hardball politics. I think his brother, his father had joked after Kennedy had won the West Virginia primary, and he said, "How many votes?" He says, "I promised I'd deliver a victory, not
no landslide.
No, I'm not going to pay for a landslide." So they weren't above dirty politics, but I do think there's something within that generation of the Kennedys, which was different, which ultimately led to both of them being killed by the system, you know, by the CIA.
Well, yeah, there was definitely multiple party involvement, and yeah, you got to have the cover up all straightened up and ready to go.
Well, the deep state, and what we mean by the deep state, this milieu of interest of informal contacts that form over the years, the military industrial complex, the intelligence, the private intelligence links or organizations.
Oh, sure. You know, this is entirely you could say it's informal, but this web of interconnections.
Yeah, look, I mean, a good example, illustration of that is the right after when Carter tried to get control of the CIA, the Halloween Massacre, and you had, you know, Ted Shackley and Klein and all that working with the October Surprise and the arms shipments to Iran and all that with Ed Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, all these private organizations that are functioning. These guys aren't going to go away. They're still going to, unless you have them put up a wall and shot, you know, they're going to be there with all their contacts, and they're going to work against you. And it appears that's what they did with Carter after the Halloween Massacre.
You know? Well, you know, I did just to give a simple example of the just looking at the public data. One of the articles on my site, nomoregames.net, is just look at the defense outlays from 91 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then you've got Bill Clinton in office for two terms. And then you look out there at the year 2000. And what do you see? It's the total outlays were like 10% decline. And in real terms, it'd be even more, let's say another 10%. So the military was shrinking. It had no reasonable enemy in the world. I mean, none. You know, not even, we don't even have to use a qualifier about no industrial state or a nuclear power. None. And then what do we see? 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got this new enemy. It's called the Muslim world. Now, don't tell me, anybody, please, that it's not that wide as the Muslim world. It's only about some jihadis or extremists or terrorists. Come on, you probably murdered a million plus people in Iraq alone. And it has nothing to do with 9/11. So don't tell me it's not a war on the Muslim world. And oh, where was this enemy prior to that? It's just, hey, I'm sorry, they're not our enemy, you know? So, and then there are no hijackers, folks. And, you know, it's not just my website showing this cartoon-like penetration of the South Tower. Elias Davidson has his book now. I think it's a 1914. It's something. The title, I don't have it right handy. It's like Counterfeiting the American Mind. There's no evidence of Arab hijackers. So you go look at that book, Elias Davidson.
That's right. Yeah. The manifests don't have the names.
The peculiar thing about his book is he never makes any bow towards the no-planers. You know, in other words, hey, these calls are fake from the planes. You know, the whole thing is fake in terms of the late videos they made out of National Airport. You know. And there's no evidence from the ACARS data that American 77 ever left out of Dulles, and on. You know, in other words, you start looking at it closely, and everything shreds in your hands. And that's another thing about, you know, I mentioned I can't make it in politics because I'd start smiling when I lie. Well, you know, these guys are brazen in terms of how many loose ends and contradictions there are everywhere you look on 9/11.
Yeah, the contradictions are just, well, you can't reconcile, and that's the problem. You're faced with a conundrum. But a good example of that would be we have the Pentagon scenario narrative where Flight 77 slams into the side of the Pentagon, I think going 500 miles an hour,
a
few feet off the ground, which, I mean, aeronautically, I didn't think was possible. And I have
You cannot land an aircraft at 500 miles an hour.
Yeah, the air is too dense.
Less than half of your wingspan. You know, because air is a cushion, a gas, right?
Yeah,
It's going to keep you, it's like, accelerating an aircraft. Guess what? It's going to go up. It's like doing a wheelie on your sport bike, folks. In other words, there are all these physical principles that are violated by the government story.
Well, one of in the Zachary Massari trial in Alexandria, it was admitted that there was no phone conversation between his wife was on the plane.
Ted Olson,
Barbara Olson.
Barbara.
Do you remember that? Remember that detailed story told of Barbara Olson calling her?
Oh, sure.
Okay, at the Justice Department, I guess, because he was the Solicitor General, I think.
Right, Solicitor General, right.
But the FBI admits in the trial that there was no phone conversation.
I didn't know that.
That's good. So I don't know how – now, I'm not going to – how do you reconcile that? Remember, he gives detail about –
Ted Olson, when he was Solicitor General, of course, which is the main attorney in Supreme Court cases for the DOJ – he's famously said that, hey, if it gets serious in the government, you need to lie. We have to lie.
Now, I don't know what that means about Barbara Olson, and she's no longer around anymore. I don't know what that means. I don't know what happened to her. All I know is that it was on the news at the time. It was told this harrowing story about him getting a phone call from his doomed wife. And this is how we get the story, of the box cutters, I think. I think that's how we found out about box cutters.
Got to tell you a personal encounter there. I was at the U.S. Department of Labor as a new chief economist 1 week before 9/11. And I went over to the Fox News studios on Friday for an interview with Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Labor, through the whole George W. Bush administration. So I'm an aide or assistant, and I walked by a couple of offices, and there was Barbara Olson, and then there was Tony Snow. Tony Snow I actually knew casually. So there she was. Now, supposedly she died there in the following Tuesday. But she was in her office there at Fox News on Friday.
What date was this?
Well, I'd have to back up, but it's the Friday before 9/11.
Okay.
Yeah, Friday.
Yeah, she claimed to be on board that flight leaving Dulles. The videotape of supposed hijackers getting onto the plane at Dulles Airport.
That was faked.
It's fake.
It was a long time of day for opening.
Long time of day. Light was bad, and there was no date stamp on it.
Yeah.
So who's feeding that? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what happened to Barbara Olson. And people ask me that.
Most of us are taped dozens of times a day.
Yeah.
Different cameras. And then they have none out of Boston, none out of Newark. And, everything is, it's full of holes, folks.
Yeah. And the videotape they have of Muhammad Atta is that when they left Boston to go get a connecting flight at Portland.
Yeah, what is up with that?
Which makes no sense, because why would you involve a connecting flight to these things? So it seems like some sort of – they were patsies, some sort of intel operation. They were – I mean, I don't know. I had a conversation.
They had two cars. He left a rental car there at Portland Airport, and he left one at the Boston airport with a bunch of manuals and Koran. Manuals not to fly a Boeing
7. Yeah, and the luggage is left behind.
I asked John Lear, the famous retired pilot one time. I said, now, why would they do some of these stories? He says, I don't know.
I think it's all a psyop. I think it's all just to screw with everyone's head.
I think I guess so.
That's the only thing I can
say. Besides, most people aren't attentive enough, you know, to be following up on any of these lies. It's like Hillary Clinton again, you know. She just throws out one lie after the other, and then somebody comes along and says, hey, this isn't true. I mean, even though it's a minor lie and not even necessary. So.
Oh, yeah. It's, so, and again, it's one of the – I had a discussion over the summer regarding, you know, some of the 9/11 stuff, and somebody brought up the idea that, you know, some people believe about 9/11 no planes being used. And I said, well, I don't know about that. I can't commit to one view or another. I do know that there are anomalies in what I saw on television. What most people don't realize is most people experience 9/11 through the medium of television. It's a medium, therefore it's subject to some form of manipulation. If you go through the history of news media, manipulation, fake news, there's a long-standing history of that very thing occurring, right? You have the CNN faking missile attacks during the Gulf War, using blue screen then green screen. That probably happens more often than people realize with the news. So all I know is you're watching something on television. You're assuming what you're watching on television is real, but it's a medium. It's a studio, which means it can be produced. So to look at the my point is the forensic evidence provided by what we see on television may not be objective, correct evidence of what really occurred, because we're watching it. I saw a plane go through a building. Its nose come out the other side for a few seconds on live television. And that's impossible.
Yeah, that's one of the troublesome videos, all right.
Remember that? The guy says, oh, look, you see its nose poking through. And that's supposed to be in real time, and that's occurring.
But I'll tell you what I have found, and this is very important work that Richard D. Hall in England has done, and that is he set up a 3D model of southern Manhattan, northern New Jersey, and he started out with the 52 videos of the South Tower hit, you know, with a plane image in it, and he could use half of them. There was enough footage to plot, to track the path, the flight path. And while they look different when they from different locations, but it coincides with the flight path on radar. There was a different military one, which is offset to the east by 1,400 feet, but that was explained ultimately by the location of that military radar track was further away than the civilian one. In any case, every plane image he's got with sufficient footage has the same flight path. So what that would mean is, hey, it would be way too hard to insert a plane image into every video. I would argue that that's the right position.
Yes.
So all these video cameras, which are allegedly amateur, which is probably true too. Well, you know, the Evan Fairbanks, you could say he's a professional, et cetera. But they all coincide. So there's a real image there.
Yeah.
Is it a real aircraft? No, it's not. It's some kind of projection system. Okay, so and we know this for a lot of reasons. The main one is the lack of debris, the lack of a violent collision.
Which
has got to be a violent collision. The plane is basically going to explode. And the notion that what you see in these videos, which is absolutely smooth penetration, including the tail section, which is a heavy outlier way at the back of the frame, the airframe. You know, the dang thing is over 40 feet tall. That thing would snap, and especially in South Tower where the plane image hits the building at an angle. In other words, it's not flush, you know, perpendicular to the hit, to the building. Well, the thing would snap off right away. And I've got a video you might have seen on my nomoregames.net, which shows, you know, these claws. They're taking down a prototype Boeing 767, which has been stripped of its interior. And what they are doing is reclaiming the aluminum, you know. And the way they bite into this plane just shows you it really isn't much bigger deal than a beer can. You know,
yeah.
They keep calling it's a flying beer can, you mm-hmm. know. And the idea that this can smash through the strongest building in the world is absurd, you know, where you've got 7 or 8 floors because the thing is dipping to the left, okay, and that right wingtip is up on the right side. And you're going to encounter 7 or 8 floors of reinforced concrete, these 14-inch square steel columns, which are on 1 meter centers. And within 39 feet, you're going to encounter the core, which is nothing but steel and concrete. You know, you know how the floors on the the Trade Center towers were? You had a big center section occupied by three stairways, elevator shafts, probably restrooms and some utilities, okay? And then there's a big surrounding rectangle of office space, freely open office space. But in 39 feet, and these airliners are 159 feet, as I recall, long, okay? So in other words, the plane's going to be in a world of hurt. Right quick.
Yeah, I think the problem most people have with that is it suggests a level of manipulation that most people aren't comfortable in.
No, they're comfortable talking about this,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
because it's not so much as Dr. Judy Wood, what does she say? She says it's a combination of poor problem-solving skills. I can't remember the second one, but the third one was terrified of the implications.
Yeah, terrified implications,
I think. I mean, you're a citizen. What you don't want are any duties as a citizen. What? That's not the way a republic's supposed to work. So it's all about career suicide. I'm worried about that. It's all about my reputation in the church or in my neighborhood or whatever. So you have a lot of people who aren't going to speak up, even though they suspect something way rotten happened on 9/11.
And you do. You mentioned the lack of wreckage in all 4 crash sites. There isn't enough wreckage you normally associate with a plane crash.
Yeah,
and of course you have Jamie McIntyre's famous observation of that day, where I see no signs of any plane crashing anywhere near the Pentagon.
Oh, you know? Right.
And then he recants. Yeah. He recants.
Well, and then you know the first thing they do virtually in a you're going to investigate a plane crash. First thing you got to do is identify the aircraft, and then what they do is look at these unique serial numbers on all these. Parts. Well, the government never offered, you know, it, and people just forget about this. Whereas Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, within 2 weeks, they go on TV, some of these Sunday morning talk shows, and promised a white paper to prove up what happened on 9/11. Guess what? Everybody forgot about it.
Never happened. Yeah.
There hasn't been any real investigation done. Like even the NIST thing, of course, that's outrageous. I went to court over that. What they did was spend $20 million on a bunch of, quote, prestigious, unquote, contractors to do scientific fraud. I mean, that's putting it plain. So everybody's impressed. Oh, they turned out 10,000 pages.
And then it's like the Warren Report.
There you go. Absolutely. You're right.
And it's also they claim they sit back and they didn't release their data they used in their studies because they claimed it was a matter of public safety or something. So there's no data to back up their conclusions. It's just
the one, you know, there's so many things wrong with it, but the one I like was that comes to mind right away was Underwriters Lab, the famous Underwriters Lab, tested, what should we say, twins of the horizontal steel and the twin towers, you know, I can't recall right now because it's been since 07, 08 that I had the case. But basically kind of I-beam structural steel. And they heated it up to as much as you could under ideal conditions with burning aircraft fuel, like 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, for 2 hours, which is way beyond what would have been experienced. And they couldn't get it to bend or fail in any way. And then, you know, they just – so this basically disproves your trash about a collapse of either tower, which is nonsense. When what you see is a building's turning to dust. And you know it by the lack of debris at the World Trade Center. But they just, you know, blithely pass that over. Well, you know, that's what – but at least they reported it. It contradicts the government story, but there you go. Nobody seemed to really care.
Yeah. The dynamics of the collapse or the destruction of the building, to claim that was caused by impact and jet fuel fire, which is just more or less like kerosene, right? It doesn't burn that hot.
Yeah, it's kerosene, and it's relatively stable kind of fuel, you know, non-explosive, you could say, put it in layman's terms.
And but the building was designed to sustain that type of impact. That's another thing. It was built to sustain impact.
Everybody remembers what they were doing there, at least all of us who were an adult on the day, that morning thereof. But I was only there a week, and I was in one of these divider corporate type desk areas because I didn't have a real office yet. And my son in Kansas City, he was working for American Century, the big investment firm. And he says, Dad, are you going to get out of the building? Because the U.S. Department of Labor is there, two blocks from the Capitol building. I said, what is he talking about? So I went down the hallway, and here is one of the bureaucrats with a TV way up high on the top of a tall bookstand. And I'm looking at this hole, must have been in the North Tower in a, because of black smoke billowing out. I pointed to it. And I knew I was taking a chance, so to speak, because I was a new employee there. I said, that building will not fall. Seemed way sensible to me. You know, they've got a hole in it up way up tall. You know, it's the 95th story or whatever. And it's smoking and billowing and a fear for the loss of life there. But... To have that thing, quote, collapse, unquote, it basically disappeared, you know, because of, you know, about stairwell B with the 14 firefighters trapped on the floors. And stairwell B is right in the absolute center of the North Tower. And these guys are trapped and they can't rescue themselves. And they keep calling for operations and da-da-da. And finally, they get a response that we're in stairwell B, North Tower, stairwell B, North Tower, stairwell B, WTC-1. And the guy on the outside says, where is the North Tower? What? You know, these guys, when the tower was unraveling, they know there's 106 stories of steel and glass and aluminum covering and concrete above them. I mean, they're just kissing their behinds goodbye, you know. Damn, I went to work today and there's so many things I got left to do and it doesn't look like they're going to get done. And after a few minutes, they suddenly see a shaft of sunlight coming through. And they walked out on, it was like a football field. Yeah, of course there were some scraps of steel and other debris and but you still had one corner of the North Tower, which I don't know, was six stories high or something, you know. But where did they, and people were just gawking, standing there. They couldn't believe it for good reason because it was destroyed by an unfamiliar technique.
Yeah, some sort of exotic weaponry, it appears.
Yeah.
Which, again, gets another inevitably that results in, well, conjecture or speculation, because you're dealing with something that you can't identify. You can't.
Well, it would be like Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as Dr. Judy Wood would put it, you know. Well, all we know are the effects, really. But there's some kind of new, you call it free energy technology. That's
something strange. That's if you really think that we're privy to all the inventory weapons that the deep state has at its disposal, you're being a little naive. So,
Here's a very good point, though, to make about the perpetrators. This was very well thought out, because number one, if you use exotic, unfamiliar weaponry, that's going to make the inevitable sleuths who pursue this and don't buy the government gobbledygook look stupid, right?
Yeah.
Then the conspiracy theorist, that just works just fine. It's almost discrediting to point out what the really happened there. And then you've got the whole plane deceit. You know, airliners, people understand airliners, you know, roughly, more or less, we're familiar with them. But to use another form of exotic technology where you project an image, because that's the only way to explain it, really. Mm-hmm. It's not a CGI, a computer graphic insert, as some have thought. No, there are credible witnesses who say, hey, you know, I saw it for a few seconds and da da da. Evan Fairbanks, he's been unfairly attacked, I think. That was something he recorded and thought was real. But he says, you know, we're used to Hollywood special effects, but we don't actually think it happens that way. But here it happened. I mean, he's just confused.
Mm-hmm.
So you just end up saying, oh, man, it's like one day, well, we'll call it cocktail hour. My wife and I are sitting out here in our Arkansas room. We have a little wine, and I swear to God, we both saw a UFO. I mean, it's a UFO doesn't mean you're crazy. It's an unidentified flying object.
Yeah.
But it was out here on this mountain, above this mountain ridge. And it was static. It was fixed, in a sense, hovering. And then all of a sudden, it darted to my right. I've never talked about this publicly, but I swear we weren't seeing anything. Now, I don't have any, evidence or documentation. I'm just telling you what I saw with my own eyes. You know,
yeah.
I don't know what it was.
Yeah, you're not necessarily saying it's off world. It's just it's an object you can't identify. And like you say, there's the idea that, you know, that we are given, we're privy to all the full inventory of aircraft and aeronautical capabilities. That this idea of occulted or secretive technology that can be developed and be utilized, and these things can be tested or even released for a PSYOP reason. I mean, the whole ufology thing, the government has admitted to manipulating that, infiltrating it, and that there's a multifaceted psychological warfare operation. It's all about, because if you get people concerned about UFOs or aliens and all that stuff, you're going to get them going down a blind alley. These are the type of people that might investigate other things. And so the government has admitted it's been caught promoting that, you know, infiltrating conventions and leading people down blind alleys and manipulating people.
They're freaks.
Yeah, even abduction. If you want to, if you're conducting some sort of twisted MK Ultra experiment, and you experiment on somebody, how best to discredit them than give them drugs and make them think they've been kidnapped by aliens?
I happened to be on an RV trip here last February, March, and went a few miles out of my way to go to Roswell, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. You know, the famous site of something weird happened in 1947, the summer of 1947. It turned out there is a museum co-founded by three businessmen, and I liked it immediately because it said, hey, we're not part of any government program. I assume they're telling the truth. So, you know, we're not advocating anything. Here you go. And it's very evidence oriented. And, you know, this whole thing, there's a lot of evidence, people filing affidavits, you know, affirmed lack of perjury, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's fascinating, but what you're going to make out of it, I'm not sure. Something happened out at this ranch whose name, it's a Spanish name, you know, it's 40 or 50 miles out of town from Roswell. And then you go around the corner and there's a lot of this UFOlogy, as you say. And that doesn't interest me too much. I'm not much into that. But so I don't know what happened. I never did an article. I was going to do an article. I don't know what to believe. I really am not seeing any direct evidence. But there's a book about the moon hoax, the moon landing hoax by Bennett and Mary Bennett and what's the man's name? Oh, man, it escapes me right now. But it's an excellent book. It's only maybe a third of it is about the moon hoax and questioning that, you know, about the cameras can't work here and on about everything that's could only be explained by fakery. But what they say is it's very much like the crop circles thing, where some people's investigations claim some of them are genuine. In other words, they believe it's done by aliens because we don't quite understand the technology, and they're trying to tell us something, you know, that we're friendlies, don't or whatever. Whereas the government, to cover it up, has made a lot of them itself, you know, but they stamp out with boards and stuff. They break. It's not the same in detail. It's not the same. Well, that's what the Percy and Bennett. Percy, I guess it's David Percy. Anyway, this book with the moon hoax in the title. Well, what they say is something else happened at this town, I don't know, Coronado or somewhere else in New Mexico. New Mexico is a suspicious place, of course, you know, because of the Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
And all these, there's ARA, this Directed Energy Weapon Expertise Company in Albuquerque. At any rate, there's this town where they claim, the book authors claim, that was where a real alien landing happened. And the government made up this other one that we're more familiar
with. Oh, okay.
Wow. Yeah. So it's one of these distraction deals to cover up something really odd happened over here. Could be. I don't know. I just haven't seen enough to know what to think about it.
Yeah. All right. So it struck me as curious that the whole alien thing began 1947. That's the passage of the National Security Act. It also coincides with paperclip Nazis and the supposed, you know, technology. Their flying saucers or their, you know, the Foo Fighters and what type of technology that was incorporated after, you know, the defeat of the Third Reich, and so it gets into that morass.
Right.
So I always thought it was interesting that it coincided
Dr.
with
von Braun.
Yeah, so it's hard, you know. So, and he said you can't rely on people, rely on FOIA documents, because all that stuff can be faked,
misleading.
Yeah. You know, gray propaganda, white propaganda, black propaganda, and it is to me, it's a great way to distract and send people down the wrong path if you want to get away with something. And I think it was Catherine Austin Fitz who said that, we're talking about, she was supposedly, she was approached by someone who wanted to meet some aliens. She thought it was a way that she was being entrapped to be discredited because she was a government whistleblower regarding all the financial fraud over there at HUD. But she says that there's nothing about UFOs or aliens that can't be explained by black budgets and and MK Ultra, psychological warfare.
And, well, you know, there's another. I always doubted the aliens or extraterrestrials because of thinking about the speed of light as being a maximum, which I never understood why it should be. But let's suppose or what the rationale was. And now they claim, of course, that accelerator thingy over there in Switzerland that they have, at least
the
for
CERN thing, yeah.
Yeah, CERN. But now there's another theory that I think Andrew Johnson in England, his website checked the evidence. I think I saw this there. And by the way, the law of gravity is under dispute. At any rate, they thought that the speed of light would be variable depending on where you are in our solar system, or certainly galaxies. So you could be, traveling at 10 times the speed of light under different circumstances. And that's a very interesting idea. And I never understood why it was a fixed speed limit to begin with, but let's accept that for the sake of argument. So, maybe you can, what is it? What's the nearest star? Centauri, something or other. But it's supposed to be 1.8 light years away. So you have to travel the speed of light for almost 2 years to get there. And it wouldn't be a pleasant place to be anyway. But in other words, these distances are so immense. So how do aliens overcome that? Well,
yeah. I get this. There's an idea. Talked to Paul and Philip Collins as a writing duo. They have a new book coming about, Invoking the Beyond, and part of that is ufology, and the idea that it is a psyop. It's the same way. It's to overwhelm the psyche in order to demoralize them, and the idea of this of a greater power coming in and just overwhelming us. It's the same effect that maybe the you might have gotten with when the Spanish showed up there in Mexico with their tall ships.
Yeah.
Or what we get when we watch a movie about.
Well, I never understood that about Hollywood. They always portray aliens as a huge enemy, and then we run out of enemies here, they'll make up
a new one. Yeah.
But hey, if they're so advanced, how'd they get there? You've got to have peace and advanced technology that really comes through peace, despite all this talk about, hey, warfare is the greatest way to accelerate technological advance. Yeah, right, the art of destruction. Well, so, I don't get it in terms of they're much more likely to be friendlies.
Well, the alien mythology has been used to manipulate the mass hysteria. Of course, we got that with War of the Worlds, Orson Welles, which turns out was
mass hysteria, really?
Yeah, it was the Princeton Radio Project. They were singing, and this is the run up to the Second World War. It's a test of how you could create mass hysteria.
Yeah.
They're
pretty good at this psychological operation.
Yeah. I think the report from Iron Mountain, which some people claim was kind of a satire.
That wasn't put out seriously, I don't think.
No. Yeah, but there is talk about invoking alien invasion as a way to mobilize public support, coalesce the public. That's the same thing of creating the enemy abroad, right? It's the same effect, whether it's the evil enemy abroad.
Well, it comes to that quote I had here. It's a famous quote from Hermann Goering. He I'm sure was executed after the Nuremberg trials to bring justice by the victors.
He allegedly says
in part, hey, of course people don't want war, da 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 da, but voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That's easy. It's a piece of cake. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked, your way of life, and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to greater danger.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Well, that's a good way to close that, I think. I think I've had you for, almost 2 hours. Yeah,
went by in a hurry.
But I just want to thank you. We've gone from Abraham Lincoln to UFOs, so there you go.
Yeah, it's hard to cover much more ground in 2 hours than that. Yeah.
But it's like you said, if you think that a lot of the stuff is nuts, well, we live in a nutty world. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Dr. Reynolds, thank you for coming on the show.
And thanks for inviting me. Yes, it was fun.
And your website is nomoregames.net, correct?
Correct.
And you no longer have your podcast, right? You're retired from that?
I did, but I think I need to get back into that.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Different, yeah, because hey, you can do it on your own, and you learn quite a few things that you don't learn in the print medium.
Yeah, just by talking to people, and it stimulates thought, and it exposes you to ideas and works that you might not otherwise come across.
Right.
So, and it's a form of form of vanity and therapy, because I get to talk about these things.
And maybe your wife doesn't have to listen to some of it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I can unload on the internet instead of her. So there you go.
Right.
So, and after I figure talking about having to save the world, she'll tell me to shut up and take the garbage out.
Yeah. Reality there.
So listen, thanks a lot.
You bet.
And maybe perhaps in the near future we'll talk again.
Okay.
I know you're going on a trip soon, so have a safe trip and enjoy it.
Yep. Yeah. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.